going on? This is Toki and Noah, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of Chicago Bullseye. Very special edition as we have a legendary figure in Chicago sports on the line. The great Bulldog Kevin Anderson from NBC Sports. Man, it's an honor to have you on, brother. It's finally good to have you on the Bullseye.
Legendary is a bit much. I don't know about that. That's too kind. You know, if you were having maybe Kendall Gill on, I'd say Kendall is legendary, which he is in his own right. But, I just do my part with what we do here at NBC Sports.
How does Kendall, I mean, as a U of I alum, where did you go to college?
I actually am from the East Coast. I'm from Maryland, so I went to a Division III school called York College of Pennsylvania.
Wow. Okay, so I went to U of I, so obviously Kendall's a legend to me, and I mean, just, you know, living legend, and just, it's amazing. What is the secret of that guy that looks so young? Does he use an oil valet between commercial breaks?
He works out every single day. Like, I don't think he takes a day off ever, and like, he's perpetually pulling 2-a-days. He's in amazing shape all the time. I mean, the guy was a professional NBA player for 15 years. He was a professional boxer. He's done the Big Three on Three league with Ice Cube. The dude is in amazing shape. He just turned 50, literally like 2 weeks ago.
That's so amazing.
He's doing well, man. I got to be honest. KG is one of the best people I've ever met. I love the guy to death. I consider him a very good friend. And I'd do anything for him.
I might have to pull some strings in to have you get him on the Bullseye in a future episode, because that would be the ultimate for me. At that point, I could call it quits and go off into the sunset, because that'd be just he's one of my heroes. Big reason I went to U of I. Now let's get a little bit on to you, though, my friend. A little 411 on you, Bulldog. I mean, you have built yourself quite a name in the Bulls Twitter universe, Bulls C-Red Nation. You're one of the shining lights, I think, as far as, you know, valuable insight about the Bulls. The podcast that you're often a part of, to me, is the best one out there, and I encourage everyone to
listen. Well, thank you. That's very kind.
It's fantastic. But why don't you pull the curtain a little bit and give us a little 411 on your history. Most importantly, your history as a Bulls fan, and if you are. Now that you've revealed you're from the East Coast, oh, my God, please don't say that.
Yeah, so I actually grew up a Lakers fan because I fell in love with basketball in the 80s watching Magic Johnson. And that is how, like, I just came to fall in love with the game of basketball, was watching Magic. They were on, I think they were on CBS at that time before NBC got the deal in the late 80s, early 90s. And so they'd always be on national TV. I mean, as you know, it was always Lakers and Celtics all the time.
Yes.
And so I fell in love with watching Magic play, and I just thought he was, I mean, to me, he's the greatest point guard of all time. One of the top five greatest players of all time. Mm-hmm. And, like, I fell in love watching Magic and the Lakers. So I grew up a Lakers fan, being from Maryland. I mean, the Bullets, then eventually the Wizards, during my time as a kid growing up, were not really very good. And so I kind of latched on to the Lakers. And so, as you go through the 80s and 90s, certainly when MJ came into his prime, they were on national TV seemingly every single game. Mm-hmm. So I really came to like and enjoy, watching Michael. But it wasn't until I moved to Chicago in 2004 that I really became a Bulls fan, because all of a sudden, as part of my work, I was covering the Bulls nearly every single day. And so it's really from 2004 and through the Scott Skiles years and the Vinny Del Negro and the Thibs and where we are now that I really came to like this team, get to know the front office personnel, the media people, public relations behind the scenes. And I love the game of basketball, and I've just become in the last 13 years I've just become or 14 years I've become a pretty big Bulls fan.
Awesome. So, interesting aside, I know this is off script, but you mentioned that Magic's in your top five. He's in mine too. I'd be curious to hear, what do you rank 1 through 5 all time?
Yeah, I think Michael's number one, and you know, you can have the debate versus LeBron, but it's always going to be Michael. It's just
you can't have Michael.
Like, I got to be honest, if Michael was playing in today's game with today's rules without the hand checks, he'd be averaging 40 a game, and there would be no one that could stop him. No one. And so, like, you go back, and he still was able to average 35 and 36 and 37 a game with the defenses and the rules the way they were back then. So Michael's my number one. Number two, I probably go Bill Russell. I think I go LeBron, number three. I mean, there's no denying LeBron's greatness. And you could say what you want about his NBA Finals record, but he's about to get another loss in that regard. But at the same time, to play in eight straight finals is unparalleled in the last 40 years in basketball. So I go LeBron, I go Magic, number four, and I probably would go Kareem, number five for me.
No, that's great. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned it about Michael. People like to throw out the fact, you know, that it's a different era. It's not really that different. It's not like he was 20 years ahead of LeBron, right? I mean, he finished his career right when LeBron was starting, and agree, the game has evolved, and it's a lot more of a three-point shooting game, but I always point to the guy hit 6 3-pointers in the first half of a finals game. So don't tell me if it wasn't a focus for him. I still remember the interview in game two after he did that against Portland, where he was kind of saying the reason why he doesn't shoot threes is because it's more valuable for his team to put the pressure on the defense to attack the rim. And that always stuck with me. Because that question does come up. Well, the game's evolved, right? If it was a three-point game in that era, don't tell me Michael Jordan wouldn't develop the ability to hit three-pointers at a 40% rate. He would have been in the gym until it happened. So,
And the thing is, I got in an argument/discussion a couple weeks ago specifically about Magic, and someone on Twitter made the absolute outlandish claim that Magic, if he was playing today, wouldn't be a top five point guard among active point guards in the league right now.
Insanity.
And, like, that's just absolute pure insanity. I mean, you've got to be 12 years old to believe that, never having seen Magic play ever, to think that he wouldn't be a top five point guard in the league right now, let alone the greatest of all time to run that position. And so the argument that this person was making is that Magic's three-point shooting percentage was very low, you know, and it's certainly, the thing is that people don't realize is that the three-point shot in the NBA didn't come in until, I think, 79. I think it was Magic's last year at Michigan State.
Right.
Was when the three-point shot first came in the league. And as you know, through the 80s, there was no emphasis put on three-point shooting. I mean, you had certain players like Larry Bird who were lethal from anywhere on the floor, but the emphasis on the offenses wasn't put on that. It was just a different game from a coaching standpoint. And you can best believe that a guy like Magic or Jordan or Isaiah Thomas, I see this argument thrown all the time about Isaiah, about he was a horrible three-point shooter and a bad shooter. Magic was nearly a 90% free throw shooter.
Yes.
You can't convince me that a guy who could shoot free throws at that level, who had great form, couldn't work himself into becoming a great three-point shooter if that's what the team asked of him. You can't convince me of that.
You're absolutely 100% right. First of all, the three-point shot, too, all those numbers, they rarely took them. So every time there was a long shot before the quarter ended, it was usually taken by one of those guys. It negatively affected and impacted their three-point percentage because those were three-point attempts.
Yeah.
And they just didn't take as many in those days. So all of their three-point percentage numbers are significantly lowered for that reason, because at the end of every quarter, they'd look for the guys who had the ball in their hands, and that'd be guys like Magic who'd have to throw up a half-court shot, three-quarter shot. They weren't like Kirk Heinrich holding on to the ball while time ran out, so he didn't negatively affect his three-point shot percentage. So that always affected it, and it just wasn't a focus for them. And whoever this idiot is, this millennial you're talking to, that thinks Ben Simmons is a poor man's Magic Johnson, and regardless of how poor Magic's three-point percentages, it's better than zero, which is what Ben Simmons was this year. So give me a break. I mean, it's insanity that people act like this is a... I buy it with guys like Bill Russell. I don't have Bill Russell in my top 10. I mean, it was just... I mean, that's a completely different era where you had a bunch of, you know, six-foot-four white guys playing power forward. I mean, come on. You know, and you look at Bill's stats offensively, he wasn't... To me, he just doesn't deserve placement in that top five. But, you know, he's still a great player for his era. Where I disagree is people are like, you know, say, oh, act like Jordan played like 30, 40 years ago. They played in just adjoining eras, right? And the game really didn't start
shifting. Yeah, like side by side. Like, you had Kobe kind of, like, bridge that gap in terms of superstars between Michael and LeBron. And, you know, they kind of, like, they weren't contemporaries, but they're pretty damn close. I've actually got a good stat for you because I looked it up when I was having this argument about three-point shooting. So between 1980 and 1992, only 78 players in that entire 12-year time span shot 40% from three with at least 50 three-point attempts in a season. Between 2006 and 2018, so same time span, 12 years, 439 players did it.
Wow.
78 to 439. And that's just, I mean, that right there speaks to the development and the emphasis that's been put on the three-point shot.
Yes. And understandably so. I mean, the game develops, it progresses, and the rules changes really put more of an emphasis on the three-point shot because you really need to value spreading the floor, you know, due to the fact there's no more hand-checking. If you allowed hand-checking back in the game, I really do feel like it would really lessen the importance or impetus on the three-point shot. You'd see go back more to a post game. I mean, you saw it then. How old are you, Kevin, if you don't mind me asking? I thought you were younger.
I'm 41.
Oh, my God. I can't believe it. I thought you were a millennial. I thought you were one of the few smart
millennials. I know. I tried to stay young, and I tried. I wish I could say I was like Kendall, and I was getting to the gym and working out every single day, but I do try and stay healthy, and I do try to have a positive outlook on life, and that
it's
helps
awesome.
Me feel young at least.
So you remember the game back then. It was a post-game, emphasis on centers, get the ball to the guys down low. I mean, that's all Krause lived for was we got to get a guy that we could throw, you know, into the post, and that's why he made the trade for Oakley for Cartwright. You know, so it's so interesting to see how the game's evolved. That's why, like, Jordan was kind of, to me, a real aberration in that era as a guy who was able to lead his team from kind of like the two-guard position and be such a focus. All those other teams had, even the Pistons had Adrian Dantley, you remember, as like they all had like post answers, guys that throw the ball in the post, all those good teams, Ewing for the Knicks and even Robert Parrish for the Celtics, obviously Kareem for the Lakers. And and Jordan was the kind of the aberration. He didn't really have that. He had Oakley you know, he had Cartwright to a certain degree, but I always laughed. You know, the Bulls would always throw it to Cartwright in the first, like, six or seven possessions, and then they knocked off that nonsense when they were down by five.
I know.
When Michael...
I know. Were there certain players in the league that would dominate in any era? Wilt Chamberlain certainly is one of those. LeBron is one of those. Michael's one of those. There are certain players, like, and it pains me to say, like Steph Curry, who I don't think Steph would see nearly the level of success that he sees in today's game if he'd been playing 20 years ago.
Oh, 100% right. He would be. Imagine if he had to go through the Pistons. I mean, the guy wouldn't be on the court. He'd just be broken in half. I hate to say it. It was a more physical game, and he's just not built strong enough to handle that. Now, LeBron could have. I think LeBron is strong enough that he could have played in any era, and that's why I have him two on my list. There's Jordan. There's a Grand Canyon. Then there's LeBron. But you can't erase, like, people, the millennials I argue with, you know, he's definitely done incredible things. I've been blown away with how great he's been in these playoffs. But you can't erase what happened in 2011. He had a better team than Dirk Nowitzki, and he was outplayed in the finals by Dirk Nowitzki. That never happened to Jordan. That never even came close to happening to Michael. And the game was never too big for Michael. So to just act like that didn't happen, no, that's on his record. And that's there for all time. So you can't say he's better than Michael because Michael was the best player on the court for six finals championships. Hey, I got more time now.
It's become a cliche to say Michael was 6-0 in the finals. And I get that. And that's certainly, I think, you have to take into account. And that speaks to Michael's competitiveness and his ability to will a team to win. But, you know, he had Scottie for all six of those, playoff, runs as well, and so it makes sense. But LeBron is still a great player. But here's the last thing I'll say about LeBron: is we tend to, specifically here in Chicago, dismiss him. And I don't think LeBron's perfect. He is a crybaby at times. He flops at times. I think he just whines a little too much on the court and shows up his teammates and shows up his coaches at times. But he is absolutely one of the best to ever play the game.
No doubt. I would counter real quick. Everybody throws that out. He had Scottie. Michael had Scottie. For that sixth title, He really didn't have Scotty. You know, people always forget. He missed half the season. He waited to get his back surgery before the end of the season. He missed almost, I think, the first 40-some games. And he wasn't Scotty in the finals. I mean, go back and watch those tapes. He had some awful games in those finals against Utah. He didn't play great, if I recall, against Indiana in the Eastern Conference Finals, which was the closest they came to losing. And, you know, that was really Michael. You know, carrying those guys throughout the and Tony Kukoc to a lesser extent. Anyhow, hey, I got more time, FYI. I just texted, so I pushed this back. So I hope you don't mind. Is
that
okay?
Good. Our conversation's going well. We should let it go for a little bit.
Sounds good. Perfect. So let's get back on to the script. I'm bewildered on the state of the angst among the fan base currently with this team. I mean, I people like to portray me as this insane optimist. I haven't always been that way. I mean, I felt there was no hope under Krause, and you know I just feel that Paxson has done an excellent job overall since he was hired. So I'm bewildered on this state of angst. Where do you fall on the spectrum? 10 being, you know, C. Red Fred, myself, optimistic and believe in the direction of the team, and 1 being more like a Bulls blogger, FireGar Pax Nation. You know, I'm not even supporting the team until these guys are gone.
Yeah, I'm probably like a 6.5 to 7. I probably put myself at a 7. I mean, the angst and the anger from the fan base, I feel, is somewhat justified in terms of what we've seen over the last, you know, during the Garpax era, really, over the last 10 years. There are certain moves and certain decisions that have been made. And I know everybody plays up the Jordan Bell thing, and I get both sides of the Jordan Bell argument. I get the side that they probably weren't going to, you know, draft him anyway, and they essentially only drafted him because that's the trade, and that they would have essentially drafted somebody else if they were forced to draft somebody. That in itself bothers me because Jordan Bell, for a second-round pick, is a pretty good player. I don't like how they handled everything with Thibodeau, and certainly going back to their draft history, you've had these streaks in which they've had amazing drafts, amazing player development, and it kind of ended with Jimmy Butler, and then you had this stretch of 4 or 5 years in which they just bust after bust after bust, and it kind of started with the Marcus Teague pick, and instead of going with Draymond Green, even though significant members of the coaching staff were advocating for Draymond Green. And so that's why when someone says 30 teams passed on Draymond Green, right, or 29 teams passed on Draymond Green, so you can't fault the Bulls for passing on Draymond, the counter argument is those other 29 teams didn't have a member of the coaching staff going into the front office and going, we need to take this guy. He's going to be a great player. He'd be a perfect fit for us. So, like, you know, there are certain things within what has happened in this front office over the last 10 years that I do say I see that point of view. I see why they're upset. I see why there seems to be little accountability in regards to the front office, where the team can struggle. You can fire coaches and trade away players, but the front office remains intact. Despite not having gotten past the first round once out of the last 10 years, so I can see all that point of view. But honestly, given where the team is now, I'm very optimistic where they are. I felt the Jimmy Butler trade had to be made, and I know a lot of people felt that they should try and build around Jimmy, but building around Jimmy kept you in mediocrity. It kept you in this NBA purgatory of just being a 7 or 8 seed or a fringe playoff team, and now there's a clear direction. I know that's not what a lot of fans wanted because of what we went through last season with the team, but this young core that they have, Markkanen is the real deal. I mean, he is going to be a future all-star, and I think Chris Dunn is a solid point guard. I'd like him to improve on certain things, but he's certainly in the top 15 of the league in terms of starting point guards. And I am very high on Zach LaVine. I know that some people aren't, and I know LaVine is very polarizing among the fan base, but I think LaVine is a future all-star as well.
All right, so I got to call you out on one thing, because I hear this all the time, and you're one of the smartest Bulls fans I know. So let's go back to 2000 and when they drafted Teague, 2011, right? It was 2012. Is that correct?
It was Snell in 2011 and Teague in 2012.
Well, I think it was Butler in 2011. It was Butler in 2011. It was Teague 2012, and Snell went in 2013. So let's look when they drafted Teague. 29th pick overall. What did we have at that situation? We had Derek just off of ACL surgery, probably not available for 6 months. We had a team that was basically capped out. We had two front court guys, Noah, who we just signed to a big contract, and Taj in negotiations for a deal. And I think we all agree, and Omer Sheikh backing up. I can't recall if Omer signed that summer or not. Maybe in the subsequent summer. But regardless, you still had Taj and Noah. You had no need for Green. You did have a need for a point guard. So the Bulls get hammered on that pick at 29. And keep in mind, most of the time, most players aren't ever at 29, ever or even stay in the NBA, let alone make it. But you know who had 21, and I think it was 21 and 22, that Danny Ainge, the great Danny Ainge, he needed a front court guy. He took Fat Sullinger and Fab Mello, who's dead. So
back to back.
They had two picks in that draft. The smartest guy in the world, and he passed on Green twice when he needed a front court guy. And the Bulls, who didn't need help in the front court, and they needed a point guard, they get hammered on Teague at 29. Completely unfair. I still stay to this point. And I think Draymond Green's the most overrated player I've ever seen. I think he should thank God every day he wound up next to two of the best shooters in the NBA. And I understand what he brings on defense. And offensively, I think he's a good passer. I'm not saying he's a bad player. But he's held up at this elite standard. So I defend the front office there. And also this idea that the front office has done nothing since them. 2015 draft. Look at the top 10 guys pick. Karl-Anthony Towns, all right, great pick. Yeah. I love the guy. D'Angelo Russell, Okafor, Porzingis, great pick. Mario Hezonja, Willie Cauley-Stein, Emmanuel Mudiay, Stanley Johnson, Frank Kaminsky, Justice Winslow. Let's stop there. Those are top 10 picks. The Bulls took Bobby Portis at 22. I think Bobby Portis, if you redraft all those guys I just mentioned, is probably the third pick. Would you say?
Yeah, so? I mean, you look at that, you certainly make the argument he's definitely in the top five. If you had to redraft that entire first round, I mean, that's a bad draft. There are a lot of players who are no longer in the league or are just fringe rotation players. You've got Devin Booker, who's certainly dynamic. He'd probably go number two right behind
Miles Powell. Turner was a good pick, too, for Indiana.
Porzingis would go three. I think, you know, you probably make the argument that maybe Porzingis could go number one right now, because Towns struggled last season. But, I certainly get it. Bobby, I think, would be a top-five pick if they redrafted that year.
Right. So maybe not top-five, because there were some good picks in 11 through 20. My only point is the Bulls had a fantastic draft that year in getting Portis at 22. And I know Valentine is a flashpoint, and I think most people dislike him just because I'm so for him. But he was 15th. And everybody talks about Tibbs. You know, I think Tibbs was a disaster. I disagree with everyone. I think as time goes on, I think I'll be proven in retrospect. People will look back at that guy, what he did playing every game like it was a game seven was so incredibly dumb. And we limped into every playoff and underperformed in the playoffs and overperformed in a regular season. But, you know, everybody talked about Tibbs, you know, wanting Draymond Green. Nobody ever talked about how he wanted McDermott, went up to the office and demanded that and all the other stuff, right? It's always so selective with him.
Yeah.
And so
but the thing is, like, about Teague, the thing is, and why Teague is, like, so polarizing among, like, that as the example of one of the major mistakes, is you look at the success that Draymond has had. And, yes, you're absolutely right. Part of it's the system. But he is a huge reason of why they're a dynasty in Golden State right now and, you know, where Teague is now. So it is, but, you know, at the same time, they had great late first-round picks. They had a string of them. And to get Jimmy Butler where he was, to get Taj Gibson where he was,
Nico.
Is, you know, you're just doing fantastic. And, you know, to me, when you look at how to build a roster, it's two things. It's player development and it's player scouting. And unfortunately, we haven't had too much of success in either department. You know, there was a good 4 or 5 year stretch. It seemed like neither one of those things was happening very well.
Yeah, but then I counter player development. I think Butler was a pretty good development project for the Bulls. I think Taj Gibson was.
Oh, absolutely it was. But most of that was under Thibodeau.
How did Tony Snell progress under Thibodeau? Everybody brings up James Johnson progress under Thibodeau? Everybody brings up the ones that, of course, Butler did great under him. Nobody brings up James Johnson, who's thriving in Miami, how he played under Tom and how Snell did, you know, getting a huge deal there. And nobody talks about how, you know, Kyle Korver was a 49% three-point shooter. He shows up with the Bulls playing 20 minutes a game, you know, shooting 41% from three. That's a massive drop-off because you got an idiot coach who's playing a bum like Kyle, like Bogans ahead of him, getting him off the bench in the middle of the second quarter. I mean, you play basketball, right? You know how hard it is to sit on a bench for 40 real minutes and just expect to go out and start hitting three-pointers? It's like,
look, yeah, the thing is, Thibodeau wasn't, you know, the thing is, it's, some fans look at Thibodeau as he was one of the greatest coaches in the league.
All of them do.
That's simply not the case. There are major issues Thibodeau had specifically to his rotations and his minutes, and that was a big deal. And that was one of the reasons that he continually butted heads with the front office. And in that regard, I definitely side with the front office. But there is, you know, we could talk for an hour about who to blame for each specific transaction or each specific mistake. But when you get back to where this team is now and what we're looking at in terms of the future, I think things are looking pretty good this roster standpoint.
No doubt. I mean, they took advantage of Tom, who, again, has the, you know, look for the next week or the next day win instead of, I mean, you saw what they could have had in Minnesota. I'm a big believer in Towns. I think Towns is one of the most underutilized, best players in the NBA. He's never missed a game, incredibly durable, and they just use him. They've turned him into a three-point shooter, which he's done at a great, very excel. He's over 40%, but the guy's dominant in the post. And, you know, that said, let's get off of that because I don't want to waste your time.
Do you think Thibodeau regrets the trade for Jimmy Butler?
Absolutely not.
I mean, they made the playoffs, so that was success in that regard. But do you think if he had to do it over again, he would go, yeah, let's do a redo and reset that trade?
I honestly believe he does not because he's that. I don't think he's a brilliant guy. I think I call him Coach Rain Man. You remember Rain Man from the late 80s?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Tom Cruise, Dustin Hoffman.
There you go. Tom Cruise, Dustin. Nobody understands that reference when I say it. He's basically, you know, mentally challenged guy that was extremely brilliant in some fields. And then just a complete moron in others. That's how I look at Tom Thibodeau. He doesn't look at the big picture. Great defensive coach at one time. I think the game's kind of evolved that he's still using the same system, and his answer for everything is work harder when it's not. You know, it's not always work harder. It's work smarter. And I don't think he regrets it. I think he's so happy with Jimmy. Now, I think he'll regret it if Jimmy walks. And I'm just so fascinated by what's going to happen there because I don't think Towns likes Jimmy. I don't think Wiggins likes Jimmy. I think that was pretty apparent. And, it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, I think Jimmy would probably like to go to L.A. Let's start there. What do you think is going to happen in Minnesota? Because Thibodeau is still the most popular coach in Chicago. He's beloved there, and there's what I call the Minnesota Mice, a large percentage of Bulls fans who've gone to support the Timberwolves. They listen to the show. What do you think is going to happen there?
We're talking like next summer when Jimmy's a free agent, or in terms of like what this team to expect from them next season?
Well, like big picture, I mean, obviously, if he's going to walk as a free agent, if he's going to, I hope at some point he's going to have a conversation with Tibbs. Yeah, I'm going to sign here, or I'm not. That's got to happen this summer. Would you concur?
Yeah, I think that I don't see Jimmy extending his contract. I don't see him getting a new contract with Minnesota. Jimmy is, you know, as to quote one of my favorite players of all time, Joakim Noah, Jimmy's Hollywood as hell. And so the Jimmy, I can absolutely see a situation in which he wants to play in L.A. or New York and sign a big deal and then kind of play out his career with that next last stop. But it's interesting, that dynamic they have in Minnesota, because Towns didn't have a very good year. Wiggins has become a completely one-dimensional player. And Jimmy Butler was still Jimmy, but that team in the conference they're in is essentially limited to what is going to be a first round exit every year, unless they get massively better or get, you know, somebody else in there that's going to really help them out. And so I see next year for them, I think, you know, they'll probably be a fringe playoff team, maybe 7 or 8 seed. And then Jimmy walks the year after.
Yeah. I love how,
and then, honestly, Thibodeau, I don't think will get another contract with that team. I think Thibodeau's shelf life with teams seems to be 3 to 5 years, and I think that's going to happen again.
Oh, I mean, you would have to be insane if you're that owner and give a contract to Thibodeau after the mess he's made there. I mean, just the idea of signing Teague, who I think is one of the most overrated point guards in the NBA, understand he had a decent year. Taj, you think Taj is going to play 82 games again? I mean, that was like a miracle that he played, you know, top 15 in minutes. I'm happy for him. I love Taj, one of my favorite players. I just can't believe he got through the season. And then...
I know.
It's just amazing. And then all you hear from Tibbs is the excuses, well, Jimmy got hurt. The team would have, was on a pace with him playing like 51 wins. They won 48. And just assuming that that team would win all those games, with Jimmy, they lost to the Bulls. They lost to Orlando with Jimmy. They lost to Memphis with Jimmy. They lost a lot of bad games with Jimmy. And just assuming, oh, yeah, well, they would have gone and won 51. Regardless, Jimmy Butler played 2,200 minutes. Do you think Denver missed Paul Millsap? He played about half that. And that was their big signing. And look what happened at the last game of the season. So that guy, Thibodeau's always got the – he does a great job of throwing out the excuses without saying it. You know, so
every team deals with injuries. And
that's
I didn't hear Danny Ainge complain about their two best players not being available for the playoffs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just the reality of how it hits teams at certain times, and injuries suck, and especially when it comes to superstars, tear ACLs and get hurt, as we very well know. But, you know, the thing is, if you're a good team, you work past that. And certainly what the Celtics have built and are building in Boston is they should have came out as the Eastern Conference champions, and they came very close to doing that, just having one of the worst shooting nights any team's had in the entire season in Game 7. But, you know, they had their two best players in street clothes. So, you know, they were able to overcome that, and that's what good teams do.
Let's get to back to the beloved. So, the draft, a big flashpoint, big argument, pro Bamba, no Bamba. What side of the argument do you fall on?
I am more, I mean, when it comes down to it, really the argument is if Mo Bamba is there at 7, and let's operate under the assumption that Michael Porter Jr. is not there at 7, which, as our Vincent Goodwill said in our Bulls Talk podcast yesterday, that the Bulls will absolutely have to trade up if they want to draft Michael Porter Jr. And he's absolutely right in that fact. Porter, unless the medicals come back, and he's already had his physical with the Bulls, which the Bulls are going to share with the rest of the league tomorrow, because Porter's having a workout here in Chicago for the rest of the league, the entire league, tomorrow. And from what Vincent understands, that his medicals are not that bad, but there's no huge red flags there. So in that regard, when it comes to the 7th pick, it really comes down to Mo Bamba, possibly Wendell Carter, probably Mikal Bridges. You know, those are the three players that really you're deciding who's available and who you're going to take at that point. There's a chance that Jackson falls to 7, which I'm not a huge fan of. I'd pass on him. I think he's, you know, kind of a Bobby Portis gives you the same skill set for a lot less. But in those three players I just mentioned, I am very high on Mikal Bridges. I think Bridges would be a perfect fit. There are some things about Bamba's game that concern me, and I am not that big a Bamba fan. As Mark Schanowski pointed out, that Bamba's bust potential is very high.
He has no discernible offensive skills on tape. I understand he's the, you know, Captain Wingspan Bamba. I've watched a ton of his games. You know, his in 30 collegiate games, his assist total high was 2. He had 17 games with no assists. I don't understand how people think a guy in today's NBA with no ability to pass, little ability to shoot, I don't care what he's doing in a wide and empty gym. I have friends that can hit 9 three-pointers in a row in an empty gym. And it's insanity to me. I've never seen. He's got a great wingspan. He's definitely got tools to be a great defensive player. I don't draft a project at 7 when a player like Wendell Carter Jr., with proven skills, underrated passer, incredible true shooting percentage, a 78% free throw shooter, can hit the 3, and it can defend the rim, is available, and you pass on him for Bamba? Insanity. Especially when they played each other.
Yeah, it's about Bamba. Like, he's seen since the combine, because of his performance at the combine, he's seen this rise in popularity in mock drafts and among fans who look at the metrics, right? They see the numbers that he ran a shuttle, a three-quarter court sprint, faster than Russell Westbrook, Dwayne Wade, James Harden, John Wall, and a bunch of other guys, right? And so you see that and you're like, wow, this guy is an amazing athlete, that he is a, you know, just a diamond in the rough that needs to be polished a little bit, and he's going to turn into a perennial all-star. And while that may happen, we may see that out of him, I don't think that's the case, and I think it would be too risky, too much of a risk to take him.
I agree 100%. You know, it's 3.7 blocks per game. Sheem Tabeed as a freshman averaged 3.8. You know, there's just all the stuff you can point to that I think he's a major disaster. I got to tell you, I disagree with you 100% on Jaren Jackson Jr. in the fact that he's exponentially better defensively than Portis. I mean, he can defend the rim. He blocks shots. He's an excellent defender than Portis. You know, Portis, that's his biggest fault, is on the defensive end. I think he's a liability.
Right. Whereas, so if he's there, if Jackson's there at 7, let's say it's Jackson, Bamba,
yes,
Bridges, and Carter. Are you taking Jackson?
Absolutely. I think I have him ranked higher than anyone there, and I love Mikal Bridges. I absolutely love him. And you know, to me, I'm sure you get in these discussions too. A lot of people I respect don't like Mikal Bridges, and when you get down to it, there's two reasons. Number one, he's 21. He'll be 22 by the time the season starts, and I just think that's a major mistake to just blindly look at a guy's age and say he can't help it. Jimmy Butler, you can point to all these guys, and I know they'll say, yeah, well, they were drafted later in the round, you know, later in the draft. Kyle Kuzma, take that aside. This guy, you drop him on the Bulls, he's their best perimeter defender immediately, and combining him and Dunn, you've immediately got a team that can switch on whoever you want, right? Other good friend I speak to, you know, is concerned about his weight. I think he's wiry strong. I'm a lot more concerned about Bamba's 225, because if you watch tape, he can't keep big guys out of the paint. He's not strong enough. Whereas Bridges, you never see that happen. Like, Bridges can guard anybody. So I agree with you, too.
There is a recent obsession with players' ages in the draft.
I know.
You've got to draft a 19-year-old. Like, if you draft a 21-year-old or 22-year-old, that he's too old and past his prime. I mean, the reality is that most NBA players hit their prime in the 26 to 29 range. And so if you draft a guy who's 21 and he's hitting his prime 6 years later, I don't see how that is a bad thing. I mean, it's not a situation. You don't sign guys to 15-year deals. This isn't Magic Johnson signing a lifetime deal with the Lakers, right?
And yeah.
So you don't have that situation anymore. So, like, taking a guy who's old at 21, I just don't see it. I don't see why that's a major issue. And there are a lot of things about Bridges, Mikal Bridges, I really like. And I know that it's kind of become this cliche among Bulls fans about it. He's a Paxson guy, right? We know that Paxson loves guys who are winners, who are 3 to 4 year guys, and come from big time programs. And to a certain extent, that's worked for him sometimes. It hasn't worked for him other times. But Mikal Bridges is a player, and his close to the rim game, his athleticism is very underrated.
Agreed.
This guy can hop, man.
That's when he was a rim wrecker.
At the rim.
Yeah. I agree 100%. That's how he came to Villanova. He wasn't a 3-point shooter. He was a rim wrecker. And there's plenty of tape where you watch on that kid, and you're like, oh my god, I didn't know he could do that. And that's all I got, man. That's all I judge these guys by. I watch tape. I watched the tape of Mo Bamba against West Virginia. Legit competition now. I'm not talking about some of these games. You know, our good friend, you know, Mark from Australia.
We love Mark.
We love Mark. Great guy. But he had that article about Bamba. And he unearthed the only successful pick and roll that I was able to find from Bamba. I swear to God, I thought they were playing like some high school team in Barrington.